This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross.
The reason it's so important to keep down costs is so we keep college affordable.
And the president knows his stuff, y'all. That's why they call him the POTUS, which means person on top. What is it?
Jimmy, POTUS stands for President of the United States.
He's the POTUS with the most stuff.
That's President Obama making an appearance on Jimmy Fallon's regular feature Slow Jammin' the News, with our first guest, Questlove, Amir Thompson, on drums. He co-founded the hip-hop band The Roots, which is Fallon's late-night house band. Questlove describes The Roots as the last hip-hop band, the last of a dying breed in an era of solo acts. Dying breed, maybe, but the band sure is doing well. They're preparing to move to The Tonight Show when Fallon takes over as that show's host in February. And this year, The Roots' 1999 album, Things Fall Apart, after 14 years, went platinum. Questlove grew up in West Philadelphia, but spent a lot of time on the road traveling with his father, Lee Andrews, of the doo-wop group Lee Andrews and the Hearts. His dad's record collection gave Questlove a head start in becoming an encyclopedia of music references, which is one of the reasons why, in addition to all the work he does with The Roots, he spends a lot of nights DJing. Now, Questlove has a new memoir called Mo Meta Blues. He spoke with Terry Gross last month.
Amir, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have you back. Growing up with rap music and hip-hop, did you ever worry that the music you loved wouldn't have use for a drummer like you because of drum machines, because of sampling?
Never. I break down hip-hop in sort of like five-year brackets. The first period of hip-hop, which is 1977 to 1982, was pretty much the idea, at least on wax. Because of technology restrictions, the DJ would play the house band of the label that they were signed to. So let's say it's Sugar Hill Records. Grandmaster Flash would play, let's say, a particular break, like, let's say, Get Up and Dance or the Apache break, like a well-known break that he would spin in clubs. He would play it for the house band, and they would approximate it. So the first 5 years of hip-hop were interpreted by a live band. And so it didn't sound foreign to me at all. When drum machines came in, and then when sampling came in, especially in the age of Public Enemy's records, pretty much I just heard my father's entire record collection kind of amalgamated in these, you know, 60-minute cassettes. Like, probably the most seminal moment for me is Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. When that album came out in 1988, that was a Sgt. Pepper's moment. That was a Never Mind the Bullocks, Here Comes the Sex Pistols moment. And what they did was, I mean, they made a sound collage of my father's record collection. So at first it was a name that tune thing, like, oh, okay, that's David Bowie, that's Funkadelic, that's James Brown. But then, you know, it was contextualized in a way that I could relate to. So I didn't feel a threat, like, oh, I don't know how to fit in this world.
You've had such a diverse career, you know, hip-hop band, you know, recording, performing, backing up other performers, producing, mm-hmm. and for the past few years, being the house band for Jimmy Fallon's late-night show, soon right. to be The Tonight Show. Mm-hmm. And what I imagine was an incredible moment for you was when you backed up President Obama in a regular feature called Slow Jam in the News, and usually it's like Brian Williams reading a news story, with Jimmy Fallon jumping in with kind of lewd comments on the news story while you play a blues behind them. But you did right. that with Obama, with him talking about how Congress shouldn't allow interest rates on student loans to rise. I'm wondering, what were the rehearsals like with President Obama, and what was the experience like for you? I doubt you ever expected to be backing up a president.
Yeah, we didn't. What's funny is that he was probably the coolest of all of us. Like, we were, like, over-preparing and nervous and going over each syllable and, you know, usually when we do that, it takes like four or five rehearsals to nail it. And especially when you're bringing someone in that doesn't have that experience of it, it could be a risk. But with him, he rehearsed it once. He knew the timing of it. He knew that the red markers on the cue cards were his lines. And yeah, he was a pro. He nailed rehearsal once perfectly and, you know, even had a little swag at the end when he dropped his microphone.
So what did it feel like for you to back up a president?
It was a little surreal. It was a little surreal watching it. But I got to tell you, Terry, I learned long ago to curb my enthusiasm. And this is and this is the one character trait in me that the people closest to me absolutely abhor. The fact that I'm very nonchalant about everything. I'm not saying that it wasn't a big deal, but it's just that I've come to the realization that every day my life has this sort of Forrest Gump existence. Like, every day is an I was there moment. So it just becomes, you know, a little redundant to get excited about every day when every day is sort of like a high. I understand that they're high for other people, and I vicariously get excited. Like, the day that the book came out, everyone called, like, aren't you excited? Aren't you excited? Aren't you excited? And, you know, I was, like, trying to fake it, like, yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited. But really, I was like, yeah, okay, that's nice. You know, that's just how I am. I don't mourn the bad. I don't celebrate the good. I just walk for it. That's all.
So you write about when you were growing up and how when you started listening to music, you didn't really focus on the melody or the lead singer. You say, I seemed deaf to what was out in front of the mix. I was searching for a part of the song that was buried, a rare treasure that no one else knew about. Could you give us an example, a song that you listened to that had a kind of famous melody, but there was something else that
totally
you heard?
Ignored.
Yeah, that you totally ignored and heard something else in your forefront, in the forefront of your mind.
All right, let's take Where Did Our Love Go by the Supremes.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hypothetical example, but I mean, to me, the most important part of that song is the tenor sax part in the background. So while everyone will sing the lead, baby, baby, where did our love go? I will start singing, you know, I'll start singing the saxophone part that's like buried in the mix somewhere. I have no idea why that the small nuances of a song are more attractive to me than the actual song. This definitely explains why I have zero pop sensibility. I mean, I've learned the last time I was here, I was promoting, I believe, our sixth album, Phrenology, which, you know, critics sort of hailed that as like our magnum opus because it was like a everything but the kitchen sink type of record, and it was like 14-minute free jazz experiments and all these things, which should normally be quasi-impressive to people. But then I realized, like, oh, this is stuff I can do in my sleep. Like, it's easy for me to make an 11-minute song that has like 9 changes in it and all these time signatures. But if you told me to create the theme to like Super Mario Brothers, something so elementary and something so basic, I would pull my afro out. Like it's it's one of the hardest things in the world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Questlove, Amir Thompson, the drummer and co-founder of the band The Roots, which is now the band on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. He has a new memoir. It's called Mo Meta Blues. In your memoir, you write, yeah, I wasn't a normal kid. And you say your parents took you to see if something was wrong. And you say, I don't think autistic was a common term back then. So do you think that if you were growing up today and behaved like you did when you were a child, that your parents would have gotten a diagnosis of autism?
I believe there are different degrees of autism. And I'm not saying that, you know, initially at first, you know, a lot of this was also said in jest and joking. But, I mean, they did worry for a second because I was obsessed and sort of, I was always in a trance with things that spun.
Including albums.
Well, especially records.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's one thing to sit there at a turntable endlessly. Like, babysitters and my aunts used to always say, like, he is the first child to never give us trouble. Like, he doesn't scream. He doesn't even talk. Like, he just sits at the – all you have to do is get a stack of records, put them on the turntable, and he'll literally just sit there and watch them turn. And then, you know, after the third or fourth hour of it, then they started to wonder, like, well, okay, does he do anything else or does he do that? And then there were points where, I mean, they ask me why did I constantly, on my index finger, I would take my dad's records and just spin them on my index finger to watch them twirl. I liked the way the logo looked in rotation. They just thought that was kind of strange.
You DJ a lot. So when you're DJing and you're using turntables and they're spinning around, does it ever kind of put you in a trance? Is it ever incredibly distracting to you?
Yeah. it relaxes me. And I joke often. People say like, well, you know, you do these marathon DJ gigs. And I tell them like some music acts need cocaine to wind down or something. Like I DJ. Like I don't. Last night I went to a party for the first time and I wasn't the DJ. And I was telling my friend Steve, I was like, oh, like I'm so uncomfortable. I feel like Linus without his blanket. Like, and every 3 seconds I was judging the DJ's segues. Like, oh, that's a horrible segue. Like, you can't go from 120 beats per minute to 87. That just doesn't make musical sense. And she's not spinning on the one. And like after a while, I was just too neurotic about it. It was turned into like a Woody Allen scene. So I left the party. But yeah,
this was your own party. This was your book party, right?
No.
Okay.
Last night, I don't know how, I wound up at Madonna's party for her movie.
Oh,
and
okay.
Casual saying, yeah, it's party for Madonna. So, of course, instead of, you're going to meet her? You're going to meet her? No, I ran right to the turntables to hide. I did talk to Salman Rushdie, though. That was cool.
But getting back to the revolving turntables, since you used to just like, you know, obsess on anything that was rotating, when you're DJing, does it ever kind of distract you and put you in a trance?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm not hypnotized by watching it. I'm more, when I'm DJing, I have a rule of thumb. People always ask me for tips on DJing. And I'm a person that knows, I believe the rule, number one rule of DJing is you have to immerse yourself in music. Immerse. Not love music. You have to immerse yourself. And the formula for me is for every record you spin, you have to know 5 records that go perfectly with that record. So for me, it's like a chess game. I'm thinking about the payoff song that's going to be 20 songs from now, and how can I build up to that moment? Which is why people that aren't too happy with me, the only time that I will be a complete ass to a person is when I'm DJing. I absolutely want zero interruptions because I'm in a trance and you're breaking my trance. And I need to know how to get from point A to point B. And because of modern technology, this is not like back in the day where I could just pack up 200 records and hope that you like 200 of those records. I now have a computer system that has 70,000 songs in them. You know, so I can go anywhere. I can play Happy Feet by Kermit the Frog. I could play a song by Skrillex. I can play a song by James Brown. I could play the new Kanye West. I could play the old Kanye West. That world's my oyster, and I need complete, absolute concentration.
So if I quizzed you on the 70,000 records that you have on your computer that you bring with you when you DJ, would you know the number of beats per minute on most of those 70,000 records?
Oh, without a doubt.
So you have a great memory and must be incredibly obsessive, too. I think we've established that.
I have an obsessive memory on things that I think are important.
Yes, right.
Now, you know, I probably have more useless information. I mean, I can tell you the amount of times that Soul Train has used a green and a yellow lighting motif on their performances.
Could you really tell
me that? Marvin Gaye. I judge Soul Train performances also on the color combination of the performances, sort of like my Nike collection. Like Marvin Gaye has a great green and yellow for his first time on Soul Train. The Stylistics had a really great sky blue and fire red color combination. The Jacksons had a very dismal beige and white background. I didn't like too much. I thought they could have maximized it more. But then again, you know, I've watched every episode of Soul Train worth watching at least 30 times each. So after a while, you just stop watching the main thing and you just look at background parts, I guess. I don't know.
When you watch Soul Train, in addition to the color combination in the background, what are you watching for? Is it the music, how the band moves, the dancers?
My all-time favorite part of Soul Train is, without a doubt, the first 60 seconds. People ask, like, what are you looking for? And, well, let's establish, first of all, Soul Train was one of the few shows that my parents allowed me to watch when I was a kid. I could watch music programs and I could watch PBS. I wasn't big on sitcoms and cartoons and those things. So Soul Train always starts with a 30-second animation of a train dancing in outer space behind the shape of the Earth. And then at the 10-second mark, Joe Cobb, a DJ from Chicago, yells at the highest volume, "The Soul Train!" I don't have my voice now, but most people know that iconic scream. So there's already like a scary element that attracts you. Like, you're attracted to things that are frightening. People go see horror films. People ride in roller coasters. I watch the first 30 seconds of Soul Train. It's the same scary thrill. And then the next 30 seconds are my all-time favorite parts of Soul Train, which is basically Sid McCoy, another announcer who had the smoothest voice. He had a very deep cadence in his voice, and he would say very soothing, "Soul Train, the hippest trip in America, with guest stars, The Temptations." And to me, just the introduction of Soul Train, probably the craziest thing I could ever do is I could sit and watch all 1,100 episodes of just the intros of Soul Train. For me, the show's over once they say, "And now here's your host, Don Cornelius." Like, anything after that is gravy. If it's an act I liked, yes, I love Don Cornelius. I love the show. I love the dancing. Rosie Perez was great. I love the Soul Train line. The fashion was cool. Everything's great. But for me, the animation was great. Joe Cobb yelling Soul Train was awesome. But the 30 seconds that Sid McCoy has to announce who the guest stars are and them showing that 5-second action shot of the guest on the show today, that to me was the highlight of my life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Questlove, Amir Thompson, the drummer and co-founder of the band The Roots, which is now the band on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. He has a new memoir. It's called Mo Meta Blues. You write in your book that you wonder, like, how does a hip-hop band survive middle age? How do they make it into middle age and still, you know, remain fresh and meaningful? And has part of, I mean, I don't think you're quite middle-aged yet, but has being on television in the Jimmy Fallon Late Night band open things up for you? And I don't even mean financially here. I mean artistically, because you play with so many different performers on it, and you're doing comedy, and you're doing, you know, just, you know, music of every kind.
Hip hop is, you got to see hip hop in dog years. I'll say hip hop is more in pit bull years. You have to. You know, most acts kind of peak, you know, at their second, third, fourth record. Most acts, their best record's like their second album. And somehow we miraculously made it to our 15th record. I will say that initially when we took on Fallon, I guess you could say that I saw it as a great retirement. I thought, well, it goes up, comes down, and this is probably the best way for us to land, you know, on concrete, the feathers way. We'll just, you know, they told, the initial pitch was like, look, you guys will be in one place. You'll get to see your family more. You're only doing 8 minutes of music combined a week. You know, it's a great check. Have fun. And so what I didn't necessarily think was that this would open more doors than ever. So, yeah, it's made me more aware of music, and it's made me you know, it's put me right in the eye of the storm of this is my dream job. I guess you could say this is kind of my destiny. You know, I didn't think, like, back when I was a kid, like, man, Doc said I would have been watching the Tonight Show more than Soul Train if that was the case. Like, you know, I didn't think that, oh, this is where your future is going to be, like, you know, taking the baton from Doc Severson. And, you know, to me, this is a win-win all around. You know, as a band, this is the most rehearsing we've ever done. This is the most music we've ever created. You know, it's a real job, but this is a great beginning for us.
Do you have to write a Tonight Show theme?
Yeah.
Do I note a little anxiety in your voice?
Oh, boy. I'm having these nightmares of waking up in the middle of the night. We're going to write a new theme, and I'm thinking about it every second. Even now, as I talk to you, I'm thinking of that theme. We will be the first thing that is heard when the world is watching that new Tonight Show.
Oh yeah,
in February. Uh-huh. Like the music's going to be, so the music has to be inviting. Like you think of Johnny Carson, like that's stuck in your head. It's the pop song challenge. That is going to have to be the one.
Now, is it going to have a lyric like Jimmy Kimmel has a lyric?
Tariq might write something for it, but you know, right now I have to visualize it and see it. I have to figure out when the curtain opens and Jimmy walks out, like, what's that song? What's the song that 90 years from now, when, you know, they're talking about the Tonight Show from this era, like, but I also know that overthinking it, it's not going to happen by overthinking it. So I'm literally, it's going to come to me. And, you know, I have time. I have 6 months, which is like a blink.
How long is that in dog years?
I have 24 weeks. I have 3 days to come up with something.
It has been so wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
I appreciate this. Thank you.
Good luck writing the Tonight Show theme.
I'm such a fan of you. Yeah.
So exciting. Oh, I really look forward
pressure,
to it.
No pressure.
No pressure. No, exactly.
Right.
And congratulations on the book, and thank you so much.
I appreciate this. Thank you.
Questlove, Amir Thompson, has a new memoir called Mometa Blues. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Sarah Grand's new mystery novel, Claire DeWitt and the Bohemian Highway, is her second featuring the post-punk private eye Claire DeWitt. The first won a McCavity Award from the group Mystery Readers International. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, says that Grand's new mystery offers a terrific getaway for the start of summer.
It's been a while since I've heard a distinctive new American voice in mystery fiction. That girl with the dragon tattoo dame seems to have put our homegrown, hard-boiled detectives in the deep freeze. The mystery news of the past few years has chiefly come out of the land of the midnight sun, dominated by the late Stieg Larsson and fellow Swedes Camilla Läckberg and Håkan Nesser, as well as Norwegians Anne Holt, Karen Fossum, and Jo Nesbø. Nothing against the Vikings, but when I began reading a new mystery by Brooklyn-born author Sarah Gran and realized I had entered a fresh, fully realized noir world, I felt a rush of private eye patriotic pride. Claire DeWitt and the Bohemian Highway is the second novel in Gran's series featuring 40-ish bad girl detective Claire DeWitt. Following in the gumshoe footsteps of Sam Spade, Claire lives in San Francisco, a city where, she says, the weather moved inside of you, and the chill was something you would take with you wherever you went, forever. The clammy weather is the least of the takeaways from this novel, nor is the plot particularly startling. An old boyfriend of Claire's has been murdered in his house, and oddly, upon exiting the house, the killer locked the front door. Claire's investigation leads her to other unsolved cases, a disappearance of a friend on the New York subway decades ago, the theft of miniature horses from a ranch in Marin County. All these cases are entertaining enough, but in the fine tradition of American hard-boiled fiction, I'm thinking of classics like The Big Sleep and The Maltese Falcon. The crime here is just an excuse to jumpstart deeper existential investigations. The world-weary hipster voice and the absurdist perspective of Claire DeWitt and The Bohemian Highway are what really hold a susceptible reader spellbound. Think of the noir-inflected novels of Paul Auster, or even the labyrinthine stories of Jorge Luis Borges. Grand's narrative is an intricate one, where plot lines branch off, and the main investigation comes to a halt whenever Claire begins quoting from made-up books about sleuthing. Claire tells us that as a teenager, her life was changed forever when she found an old library book on the art of detection written by a fictional French master detective, Jacques Sillette. Sillette, whose writings are excerpted throughout this mystery, speaks in tough guy, oracular language, and so does Claire. Here, for instance, is Claire stretched out sleepless on her couch, mulling over the murder of her ex-boyfriend. It was only a case. Maybe that was all there was to life. One long case. Only you kept switching roles. Detective, witness, client, suspect. Then one day I'd be the victim instead of the detective or the client, and it would all be over. Then I'd finally have a day off. Grand's off-road story takes us into dumpy music clubs where indie bands with names like The Salingers play. She hops from the outer perimeter of the elite Bohemian Grove Club in California's Sonoma County down to New York's Lower East Side, where Claire misspent her youth. About being a teenager, Claire recalls, "It was a secret world. You gained admittance to at 14 and left at 20, swearing never to repeat what you'd seen." Even the most minor characters here make a sooty impression. Claire's visit to the murder victim's neighbor provides opportunity for wry social commentary. Claire says, "The neighbor's name was Freddie. Freddie was a white man, somewhere between 50 and a million, who seemed like the least happy person on earth." When Freddie complains to Claire that he didn't hear a thing the night of the murder because the Mexicans and club kids who live in the neighborhood made too much noise, Claire tells us his kind, the cranky middle-aged white men of the world, weren't exactly known for their silence, but I let it go. As that jab suggests, neither Claire nor apparently her creator suffer from the female disease of wanting to be liked by everybody. Jaded Detective Claire snorts cocaine and Vicodin and doesn't care who knows. All the while she pushes on, searching for the truth about her ex-boyfriend's murder, even as she suspects that, as her mentor Sillette once said, the only true thing is pain. I don't particularly endorse Claire's choice of painkillers, but I do highly recommend her introspective and, yes, poetic mystery adventure.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Claire DeWitt and the Bohemian Highway by Sarah Gran. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. With the season 6 finale of Mad Men 2 weeks ago, fans of the show have got a long wait ahead for season 7. On the bright side, Terry just recorded an interview with one of the show's stars, Elizabeth Moss, who plays Peggy Olson. Peggy started on the series as Don Draper's young, naive secretary. She slowly became a talented copywriter and Don's protege, while constantly trying to create a place for herself in a male world. This season was very eventful for Peggy in her private and professional life. Among other things, she became the chief copywriter at the new agency Sterling Cooper & Partners. Elizabeth Moss has been performing since she was a child. In the 1993 TV adaptation of Gypsy, starring Bette Midler, Moss played the young Louise. She was President Bartlett's daughter on The West Wing, and this year she starred as a New Zealand detective in the Sundance miniseries Top of the Lake. Terry began with Peggy's first scene in Mad Men. It's her first day at the ad agency, and she's about to meet her new boss, Don Draper, played by John Hamm. She walks into his office and finds him napping on the couch.
Excuse me, Mr. Draper. I'm sorry to wake you, but Mr. Campbell is outside.
He doesn't know I'm sleeping in here, does he?
No, sir.
That's good. Who are you?
I'm Peggy Olson, the new girl.
You go out there and entertain him?
I know it's my first day, and I don't want to seem uncooperative, but do I have to?
I see your point.
I brought you some aspirin.
Send him in.
Elizabeth Moss, welcome to Fresh Air. It's so fascinating listening back to that. Your voice is higher. You say everything with such uncertainty because you're the new girl. So most of your sentence seem to end with a question mark, even when you're making a statement. What were you first told about Peggy when you were reading for the role?
I think I was first just told anything by the script. It was pretty much all there, and or at least it seemed so for me. There was something about her that I really understood and really liked. And one of the major things was the fact that she, the entire episode, she's this sort of naive, has no idea what she's doing. She's young, and it's her first day on the job. And then in her last scene of the pilot, she sleeps with Pete. And I just loved that dichotomy and just really responded to that.
The look that Peggy has early in the series, particularly in that first episode, you're wearing like a cardigan sweater and this like long, like baggy skirt. It's the kind of skirt that hides your body as opposed to revealing it. It's like the opposite of what Joni would wear.
it's like a kind of A-line skirt, but it's long.
A-line implies more of a line than this has.
Yes, agreed.
And then, your hair early on was like pulled back, sometimes in a ponytail, sometimes just...
It was always in a ponytail.
Yeah, and with these like short wavy bangs. Not a great look all in all.
Definitely not.
So how did you feel when you looked at yourself, like when they gave you your look?
I mean, that was the character. I thought, that's what it was supposed to be. It was brilliant. I think that Matt talks about the fact that I was sort of the ingenue of the show. He had her gain 40 pounds in the first season. And that's very Mad Men, to take something that is possibly the norm or possibly been done before and turn it completely on its head. And I didn't get into this business to be a model or to show off pretty clothes or to have my hair look nice. I love acting and I love playing characters. And I mean, when I look back at the time, I remember being, oh God, I wore that ponytail pretty much for 2 seasons straight with those bangs. And I remember at the time being kind of like, oh God, the ponytail. I wish I could do something different. Now I look back and I think it's so Peggy and that look is so iconic and it's exactly how she should have looked.
I want to skip ahead to season 4. And this is you having a fight with Don. I mean, Don is like your mentor at this point. He relies on you for copy. He's kind of falling apart. He's drinking too much. And this is an episode in which, like, Don's actually waiting for a phone call or avoiding a phone call that somebody who's very close to him has died. In the meantime, a deadline is looming, and it's your birthday. Don doesn't know that. So you have a birthday dinner scheduled with your boyfriend. You keep calling your boyfriend, delaying the dinner. And then you just get really angry, and you go in and talk to Don. So here's the scene with my guest Elizabeth Moss as Peggy Olson and John Hamm as Don Draper.
I think I just broke up with Mark.
Oh. Really?
I think so.
So go home.
Nope. I'm ready to work. You win again.
You could have just told me it was your birthday.
Right, and there'd be no repercussions.
So now this is my fault?
Well, it's not my fault. You don't have a family or friends or anywhere else to go.
Go. Go run to him, like in the movies. You don't have to be here.
I do have to be here because of some stupid idea from Danny, who you had to hire because you stole his other stupid idea because you were drunk.
Don't get personal because you didn't do your work.
And by the way, I know it kills you, but guess what? There is no Danny's idea. Everything that comes in here belongs to the agency.
You mean you?
As long as you still work here.
Is that a threat? Because I've already taken somebody up on one of those tonight.
Relax.
You know what? Here's a blank piece of paper. Why don't you turn that into glow coat?
Are you out of your mind? You gave me 20 ideas, and I picked out one of them that was a kernel that became that commercial.
So you remember?
I do. It was something about a cowboy. Congratulations.
No, it was something about a kid locked in a closet because his mother was making him wait for the floor to dry, which is basically the whole commercial.
It's a kernel.
Which you changed just enough so that it was yours.
I changed it into a commercial. What, are we going to shoot him in the dark in the closet? That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
But you got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for. You're young. You will get your recognition. And honestly, it is absolutely ridiculous to be 2 years into your career and counting your ideas. Everything to you is an opportunity. And you should be thanking me every morning when you wake up, along with Jesus, for giving you another day. Oh, come on. I'm sorry about your boyfriend, okay?
John Hamm as Don Draper and my guest Elizabeth Moss as Peggy Olson in a scene from season 4 of Mad Men. Later in this episode, you and Don go out to dinner. You have a real heart-to-heart talk and get really close. He drinks too much, as usual. And you go back to the office, and he says, I'm going to be sick. And you escort him into the bathroom because he's leaning on you. He can't make it by himself. So you take him into the men's room, and while he's heaving in one of the stalls, you're looking at this urinal, realizing you're in a different world. that's usually hidden to women. And then he comes out, his shirt is kind of stained with puke and stuff, and you just totally bond on the couch and continue having this really heart-to-heart talk. Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to just talk about shooting that episode, which is largely you and he.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely my personal favorite episode. I even listening to that scene, it's so interesting to listen to something that's and not watch it, and you kind of really hear the writing and you really hear the dialogue. And that episode was it was kind of a bit of a dream. It was me and John pretty much the whole time. And so it was sort of this 8-day bubble that we existed in. And it was something that you can only really get on television in a series where you have a 4-year buildup to that episode. You just can't get that kind of drama in any other format where people have literally waited an actual 4 years to have that episode. And it's one of the things that I love about television is the way that the time that it takes mirrors real life. And, you know, John and I are really, really, really good friends, and we have a very close relationship. And so for the two of us to get to spend that time together off the set and then also to play those characters in that sort of really pivotal dramatic moment that evening of their lives. And for us to, I think, get to address things that we hadn't talked about in 4 years, you know, the baby, the fact that he knows about the baby, the fact that people think that it's his baby, or my mom thinks that it's his baby, I think, or something like that.
Yes.
And it really, to me, is such a beautiful representation of their relationship and their bond, which is not romantic. It is not sexual. It is an honest to goodness friendship.
Did you ever wonder if it was going to become sexual?
Yeah, for sure. I guess maybe early on, I mean, in the pilot, you know, they have the hand moment, the scene with Don where I try to put my hand on his and sort of try to come on to him. But I kind of always have sort of known that it wouldn't, and also hoped that it wouldn't. I mean, what I always say is, you know, the best way to kind of remain on Mad Men is not to sleep with Don. I just think that their relationship is something so unique and so special. And if it crosses that line, it just becomes, Peggy just becomes kind of one of the many.
As Peggy, one of the things you have to do is pitch ad campaigns to companies that the agency is courting. And you've done some really good ones over the years. I thought I'd play a pitch from the season that just ended. And this is a pitch for Heinz. And Heinz is launching its new ketchup, which is going to go in the market opposite other tomato condiment in a bottle that's known as catsup, because that's what the other brands call their tomato condiment. And in this scene, you're working for an agency that's a competitor to the agency Don Draper's with. He and people from his agency have just made a pitch to Heinz for the ketchup campaign. He has no idea that when he walks out, you're going to be there with people from the new agency where you're working at, and that you're going to go in and pitch. So you go in and give your pitch, and as you do it, he's standing outside the door with his ear to the door, eavesdropping on what you're saying, and he can tell that this really great pitch that you're giving, it's showing all the things that you've learned from him. So,
yeah.
Okay, so here's Peggy Olson making her pitch to Heinz for their new ketchup campaign.
So, what's the difference between ketchup and catsup? Well, catsup has more tomatoes, comes in a bigger bottle, is cheaper, but tastes just like ketchup. Now, we know that's not true, but that's what your competitors are saying. And they're selling their watered-down, flavorless sauce by pretending that they're you. Makes you angry, doesn't it? Me too. But I always say, if you don't like what they're saying, change the conversation. Heinz, the only ketchup. Imagine this, 40 feet tall in Times Square. Ketchup versus catsup. End of conversation.
Elizabeth Moss, did you go back and study old ads from the 60s to see what the ads look like so that you'd really know what the environment was for ads at the time?
Oh, God, no. No, not at all. I've done absolutely no research involving Mad Men whatsoever. Let me be very clear. Everything that I've learned about advertising in that time period is from the show. My interest has been so much more about Peggy as a woman, her emotional life, and who she is as a person.
So I'm kind of going through withdrawal from Mad Men. You know, I hate it when the season ends because I miss the characters so much. I always feel like I'm left stranded. Like, I want to know what happens, and I'm not going to find out for, like, months and months. What about your reaction? Because Peggy's in this pivotal spot now. I'm not sure if we should say specifically what happened because I know some people are still catching up with the season, but maybe I'll say it anyways. Okay.
I'm so glad you said that because I hate when people spoil things. So
you don't want me to say it?
No, you can, but just everyone's spoiler alert.
Yes, like if you haven't seen it yet, but you want to, like, give us a couple of minutes and then come right back.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ted, who you're in love with, is moving out to the West Coast because he can't bear to be around you because he loves you too much and he doesn't want to leave his wife and children. And Don has been basically exiled from the ad agency because he's been just behaving so badly. He's just been killing off accounts and undermining everything the agency's trying to do. And so in your last scene from the season, you walk into Don's office and you're kind of moving in. And you say, everything's here. So I really want to know, like, what's going to happen to your character next? And do you know?
I don't know, and I don't think the writers know either. Anything that I think might happen or could guess or envision for her, whatever it is, it's going to be better than that. It's going to be more interesting. It's going to be more complex. I love that last scene. I love that she's wearing a pantsuit.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, she's wearing pants for the first time in the office. And it's very kind of subtle in the sense that that is where everything is. That's where all the stuff is.
Right, that's the exact line. It's where everything is.
Yeah, it's where everything is. Yeah. Yeah. It's where is she supposed to go? I mean, that's where all the stuff that we're working on is. But it's, you know, for the audience, obviously, it's a big kind of tongue-in-cheek hint. And then she sort of sits down in the chair and you see the back of the head, very Don Draper moment. And it's a nice little tease.
So do you watch Mad Men on TV?
Occasionally. I tend to wait till the season's over and then watch it all kind of at once.
Why?
It's weird for me to sit and watch it. I'm too involved. I can't be objective. I see things that either I want to change or I, you know, wish I'd done differently or I I remember what it was like to be there, and I'm just too involved. I can't watch it objectively. It's too much of an emotional experience for me. So I tend to kind of wait and then secretly sort of watch them alone by myself.
Next season is the final season of Mad Men. Fans like me are sad that it's going to be ending, though I think it's probably right for it to end because you don't want to go on too long and make stories that just drag things out. Mm-hmm. What's it going to be like for you, do you think? Are you already thinking ahead to the end of that?
Yeah, I really am. It's hard not to think about. I've been doing this show. We made the pilot when I was 23, and I'll be 31 this month. And so it's a massive part of my life, and it's going to be very, very, very strange. There's something nice about it because you have a lot more time on your hands to do other things as opposed to only having 4 or 5 months off. You know, you have a whole year. But it's going to be also an incredible loss as far as my family there, you know, and people that I'm such good friends with. And it's going to be very, very strange.
Well, I look forward to the new season starting eventually.
Yes. Thank you. Me too.
In the meantime, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Elizabeth Moss speaking with Terry Gross last Wednesday. Moss plays Peggy Olson on AMC's Mad Men. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Saman, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.